Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the new episode of New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies series. And as usual, I'm your host, Olga Breininger. So as you remember, for each episode, we choose an important book in the field of Russian and Eurasian Studies, and we interview its author. And today we are having a very unusual episode because we are going to be talking about the graphic novel. The author I'm interviewing today is Julia Alexeeva, who is a PhD student in comparative literatures at Harvard University, and she will be talking about her graphic novel called The Soviet Daughter, A Graphic Revolution. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, who is Julia Alexeeva, author of The Soviet Daughter, A Graphic Revolution. Hi, Julia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How are you doing today?
I'm great. It's a little cold, but... Yeah, it's great to talk to you.
So we have a very unusual podcast today because we are talking not about an academic book, but a book which I think combines both academic inquiry and also a creative approach, which is a graphic novel. And first of all, we usually ask our speakers about the background. So could you please tell us about yourself and how you came to do what you are doing now?
Sure. So my name is Julia Alexeeva, and currently I am a PhD candidate at Harvard in the Comparative Literature Department, and I am also an adjunct professor at Brooklyn College in Cinema Studies. But before that, I was born in Kiev. My family is Jewish, and we emigrated from Kiev to Chicago in 1992. And so a lot of the book is like deals with my personal history and the history of the USSR. So I won't bore you too much with that now.
We'll definitely get to it.
Right. Well, I grew up in Chicago, but with a entirely Russian speaking family. So I kind of had those two worlds simultaneously growing up. Like the United States and the former Soviet Union, pretty much. So, and then I moved to New York for college, went to Columbia University, studied English and French, and then arrived at Harvard in Comp Lit. And as I was doing my graduate studies, I realized that I wanted to take time off to do this graphic novel. So in 2013 to 2014, I just took a year off, moved back to New York from Boston, and did pretty much nothing but drawing this book for about a year. And here we are.
So taking time out of your graduate program to work on a book is quite a strong decision. So what was it that led you to thinking that right here, right now, this is the most important project you want to focus on?
Yeah, that's a great question. I enjoyed graduate school and I continue to enjoy it now, but my great-grandmother died in 2010 after I had applied to graduate school. And in the summer between undergrad and graduate school, I found her memoirs, the memoirs that she had written about her life in the USSR. And almost immediately upon reading them, I thought, this needs to be a graphic novel. It was kind of, I don't even remember how the idea came about. It just was without a question, like this absolutely needs to be a visual text. And the, because I always loved drawing, it was, very easy for me to, imagine this as a comic book. And I've always been interested in comics, but then I was going to graduate school and just thought, well, I don't have the time or the money or, the health insurance to do this right now. So I pretty much waited until I could save up enough money. And after 3 years in graduate school, I thought, okay, well, I can live on this amount that I've saved up, and just did it and moved to New York. And most importantly, I thought that if I didn't do this now, then this, no one would be able to hear the story later on. Like, it has such a prescient and important timeliness that I didn't even realize as I was working on it. There were a lot of difficult things going on between Russian and Ukrainian relationships in 2014. If you remember, that was when the plane got shut down by Russia.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So all of that started happening as I was finishing the book. So then, of course, I had to try to finish it as fast as possible. Like, oh my gosh, like all of this is going on. But basically, I just sort of thought, okay, well, this is now a time in American history where people are thinking, where everyday ordinary people are starting to think about the word socialism as not an entirely bad word. It was no longer a curse, you know, the way that it was when I was a child. So I noticed that kind of cultural shift happening and thought, ah, okay, here's a time when this kind of book might be important and interesting for people.
This is incredibly interesting. And do you think this sense of political urgency modified your project the way you saw it originally and the end result?
I actually don't think so. I wrote out the entire script before I started drawing it. So there wasn't a whole lot of variation in terms of, like, I because it was based on her memoir and my own life, it's entirely nonfiction. So there's not really much I could change. Although there's a lot of, you know, subtle manipulation I suppose I could have done. But really, the idea was there from the very beginning. Although I did feel the urgency to hurry it up and just kind of get it done so that I could send it to publishers. However, when I received edits back from the wonderful publisher that I eventually found, I didn't realize to what extent the average reading public doesn't know very much about Russian or Soviet history. This really boggled my mind because I had been in the academic bubble for so long and didn't realize that, you know, people didn't know what the pioneers were. They didn't barely knew what the KGB was. They didn't understand why everyone was wearing uniforms. You know, so these are things that I as in my editing, I had to explain a lot more than I thought I would have needed to. I thought, oh, they'll just get it. And no, they did not. They did not get it.
So that was like an educational angle to your project that you didn't expect it to be, right?
Exactly. I didn't really expect it to be as educational. I sort of thought, oh, this is going to be a snapshot of life in the Soviet Union. I didn't think I would have to teach people about life in the Soviet Union as much. But in my editing, I realized this is what people were interested in. And I added things like little footnotes on certain pages, and it became more educational in the editing process. But I don't think I actually changed much of the original political intent. I had always intended it to be subtly political in a way that doesn't overwhelm.
This is exactly what it became.
Oh, good.
In my opinion, it's very subtle.
Yeah, and I loved the review that you wrote of it and the very last line where I think this was exactly what I was going for. I was trying to have a political angle that does not turn didactic, that tries to tell a story without avoiding politics, but without also alienating people that might not share the same political ideology.
Yes, this is how I felt very strongly about your novel, that you had a great balance between, you know, making political statements, but also not inculcating a sense of politics, making this subtle, nuanced part of your life, and also your grandmother's life.
Right. Yeah, that was exactly the point. So I'm so glad that you noticed that.
And I was interested, was it the first time you worked on a graphic novel in your life, or did you had experiences like that before?
So this is the first time that I've ever done anything so intense and so long. I've been interested in comics for virtually my entire life. Everything but superhero comics. I could never really get into those, but the kind of comics that you would find in a newspaper in the United States or at a local bookstore, I would devour them since I was a kid. And a kind of embarrassing note that my undergraduate, I had a little one panel comic that was very embarrassing and at Columbia University, where it was like the trials and tribulations of being an undergrad, you know, it was very silly, but in the, some of the summers during my undergrad years, I lived in Chicago with one of my best friends and one of her friends who then became my friend, and he was a cartoonist. And, so in living together, I pretty much just like used all of his books to develop my own knowledge of this tradition that I've only known a little bit about, except in my own kind of interest. And I developed a knowledge of how he worked and how he was able to use materials and what pens he used. And then I started going to workshops and reading books about how to do that. And it was all experimentation. I didn't really know my style yet. I was experimenting a lot. And in my third year of grad school, I had the opportunity to do a really intense kind of crazy freelance opportunity for the father of one of my good friends, who was looking for someone to create a graphic novel version of a legal brief. So he is a lawyer, and he only had 3 days to do this really intense work. And he reached out to a lot of cartoonists saying, you know, can you do this? I'll pay you. And they were like, no, I can't do this in 3 days. Like, that's crazy. He wanted a 5-page comic, fully scanned, fully edited, done, ready to send off in 3 days. And that is almost impossible. And of course, me being kind of an idiot, being like, yeah, whatever, I can do it. Like, it was a couple of days before the semester started. So I thought, okay, well, this could give me some recognition. Like, I was totally unknown, and it could give me some practice. I have like 5 days left before the new school year. I'm doing it. So it was kind of crazy. And I had been reading all these books about how to do this. And I was like, all right, okay, I'm ready. And so he interviewed me. I got the job. And then I had 3 days to draw, edit, scan everything, this comic that he had written. And it was unbelievably painful. My hand felt like it was on fire for 2 weeks. Like, I did nothing but draw, like, for a good 15 hours of every day. Like, it was horrible, horrible, absolutely horrible. And then I just sent it off. I got like some money for it and was like, all right, whew, whatever, that was done. I got some practice. My arm hurts. My hand is in so much pain, but whatever, like, I need money. Like, I'm sending it off. I put it on my resume. So I sent it off. And then 2 weeks later, in mid-September 2012, it went viral, like, on weirdly in like lawyer circles. And so some of my friends from undergrad who went to law school are suddenly emailing me like, you were on our blog. Oh my God. And and some of the law sort of circles picked it up. So for like a good couple weeks, I was like vaguely famous in the law community, which I knew very little about. I know nothing about law, but then it got a bit of recognition. And I think, and I'm so happy I did that, even though it gave me like some tendonitis, because it allowed people to, when I was eventually trying to pitch the book, you know, even though that was an incredibly hard thing to do, to pitch a book without having any agent or any publicist working with you, they had heard, you know, even very vaguely of like, oh, that graphic novel legal brief thing. So that had helped me a lot, even though it was a kind of torturous thing in the beginning.
I really love this story. And I think your protagonist, Lola, would have done the same were she
to totally.
This choice.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I'll just sacrifice my hand for a couple weeks. That's fine.
Well, since you started talking about pitching your book and, you know, getting it to the publisher, please tell more about this, because I know that it was a long process. I know you made several attempts and you succeeded, so we really want to hear that.
Yeah, it's been very difficult. So the comics industry, there are not that many publishers out there that are comfortable with publishing graphic novels or really graphic anything. Children's books obviously are one thing, and then, but in terms of publishers that regularly publish full length books that happen to be composed of text and image, they're really a maximum of 20, which is really not that much, and most of them are very small and independent. So what I had to do was go to, once I had the idea, and once I had a chapter or two written, I went to my local comics store in Chicago and just looked at every book that sounded similar to my book, wrote down the publisher, and tried to contact them. So at this point, I had very, very little created, but on everyone's website, they would say, you know, send us a chapter and we'll get back to you. So I sent about, you know, 12 or 15 of these publishers a chapter, heard nothing, heard absolutely nothing, tried to reach out to people directly, people I knew. I would meet people at comics and book festivals. And even though I received a lot of great positive feedback, I didn't receive any other substantial information. Like, I didn't get a contract. I didn't get that many rejections. It seemed like it was just impossible at that point. And the more people I talked to, the more they just said, you have to just finish the entire thing and then send it off. Which I understood, because it's hard to put so much of your time and energy and money into someone that hasn't produced a book yet, and who is rather unknown. And so I just had to do the book for a year, from September 2013 to about August 2014. I just had to do the book without trying not to think about the publishing process. I'm trying to just get the entire book written and drawn, and kind of ignoring that voice in my head that goes, what if you never get this published? What if this just becomes a wasted year of your life? You know, so I tried to push that aside, really, like, try to not listen to it at all. And it was only at the end of 2014 that I had the courage to finally send it out. And at that point, I was actually living in Japan, because I'd went back to graduate school and needed to spend a year in Japan learning Japanese for my dissertation. And so here I was in Japan, and I was totally scared of sending out these books that I had in my partner's family's basement in New Jersey. And they're sitting there, and I just had to say, all right, this is getting sent out. I'm going to, like, try to get help in sending them out. I'm just going to do it. And so finally I did, and reached out to even more publishers. And the person that ended up responding was this amazing independent publisher from Portland, Oregon, who published my friend Greg Farrell's book On the Books. So his book is about, so this guy works at The Strand, which is a very famous bookstore in New York that I'm sure many people know. But his book is about union organizing at The Strand. So I thought, okay, politics. This is my book deals heavily in politics. This is a publisher that is not afraid of political graphic novels. And I got such wonderful feedback from them. They responded in just 2 weeks. Joe Beal, who is the head of Microcosm Publishing, sent me this long email with suggestions, and it was pretty much like, all right, so we don't really know who you are. This work has a lot of promise. You'll probably have to edit it a lot, but if you're interested in doing this, we can work with you. And then just a couple months later, we drafted a contract and started the whole process. But of course, at that point, I was still in, and I am still in graduate school. So I had to sort of find a time to fit all of this editing and all of this bureaucracy and promotion stuff between graduate school. So it was complete craziness for years.
Well, and since we are talking about your grad school, let's make a little detour into your academic work, because I feel that the two you are doing are really related, and talk about your dissertation, which I know is on avant-garde cinema, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's funny that you think they're related, because usually I tell people that they're not related at all.
Are
They are.
they?
No, well, just because it's, people think, oh, did you write this graphic novel for your dissertation? I said, no. Even though that has been done, Nick Cusanis, who graduated from the Teachers College at Columbia University, actually wrote and drew his dissertation as a graphic novel, which I didn't know about until I was already drawing my own graphic novel. Something tells me my advisors would not be that into that, but so my academic work is an analysis of avant-garde documentary traditions stretching from Dziga Vertov in the USSR to the 60s and 70s in France and Japan. So I work mostly in cinema, but also a little bit with graphic narratives generally. I'm very interested in the combination of text and image, which I think is perfectly represented in cinema and animation, which is
See,
also
I
something
told
that.
they are related.
Yeah, they absolutely are, but in a way that is not often. It's very rare for someone to make those connections, so I'm very glad that you did. I would in the future I would like to do a lot more academic work on graphic narratives, just because I think there's just so many similarities between film and media studies and graphic narratives, especially animation. And unfortunately, right now, graphic narratives, I think, are lumped into literature departments, which is fine, but I think it's so much more than just pure literature. There's nothing wrong. Obviously, I'm a comparative literature scholar. Like, there's nothing wrong with literature, but there's so much visual analysis that goes on when analyzing graphic narratives that I think people assume, oh, if I write an article or two on comic books, I can just treat this as any other novel, which I don't think is correct. In the same way that when analyzing a film, you have to treat the formal elements of what the camera's doing and what the scenes are like and what the shots are, how the shots are composed, what the mise-en-scène is like. So in a similar way, I think you need to combine both textual and formal analysis when analyzing both. So that's my little soapbox that I like to go on when I talk about comic books.
So, where do you think the study of the graphic novels belongs in the universities? What departments?
Yeah, that's a hard question. I don't think there are many departments that it would fit perfectly in yet. I think this is something to think about in the future as the departments sort of get shifted around. I personally think they belong best in a comparative media studies department, somewhere where people are capable of switching between literature and film and something like animation and graphic novels and music and art, like somewhere where all of these can be analyzed in a very particular way while also comparing it to other fields. Anyway, but I'm not exactly sure those departments exist yet in the way that I'm envisioning them. And as someone who is still on the job market and doesn't have a lot of say in these things, I hope that these kind of departments are created in the future. But so far, I'm not exactly sure where they would be. Perhaps in comparative literature, that would be a pretty good place for them.
And how do you see combining your academic and creative work in future as a professional?
Oh boy. I would like to, as I said before, I would like to work more on the academic study of graphic novels, just because it's reflected so easily with the study of animation and film. But yeah, I would like to also do more graphic novels that are not completely related to academic work. Like, I really think there's something to having a work that is non-academic. That I didn't want my graphic novel to be an academic work whatsoever. And I think in order to reach a larger audience, and I think there's something valuable in something more mainstream. I don't want to do it super often. I have to admit that it is a very difficult and extraordinarily emotionally and physically taxing process that one really needs to set some time aside for. So in the future, I don't think I'd be able to accomplish something like this without some kind of substantial government grants. It's just so labor intensive. And the project that I had was very emotionally driven. It felt very needed for me and for other people. So I would right now I'm still waiting for that next thing, that next book that I think is so necessary that needs to get out there, that a story that I want to tell so badly that I would sacrifice, you know, a year or more of my life in order to do it. And so right now I think I need to take a break more than anything.
I see. Well, going back to the graphic novels, I was wondering if you have any favorites or examples you were looking after in your own work.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think this requires talking a little bit about how I drew the book or how I composed the pages and things like that.
And let's do this.
Yeah, that's great. So I love talking about it because I can get really nerdy about things like technique and reference photos. So I created the book with tons and tons of reference images. Every chapter was composed of, and every chapter was only, it was only between 8 and 12 pages, but every chapter had probably around 100 reference photos that I found either by going to the library and finding images of Soviet life in even like coffee table books or academic books. I would take so many books out of the library that were historical and they had like a lot of illustrations and photographs from the time. Everything was very, very, very researched. And every page was so full of information from other sources that I compiled until it became a kind of palimpsest where there were all of these different references that were constantly piled up on top of one another. One of the main references that I took in the book, obviously I took references from hundreds of family photos. Like I went to my grandparents' house almost every day for a summer and just looked through their albums and scanned them. Asked them like, where was this? What was happening? And, you know, they were very, very happy to tell me all of this. And, on top of that, I watched a lot of film from that time, which was very easy for me because I study film. And it's a big part of my dissertation, but any film that was set or filmed in the time periods that I was discussing, like say during the Civil War, in the Soviet Union and the, or in, like 1921, like I would find films that dealt with that. I would look through historical footage from early Soviet film and newsreels and things like that, and just drew it, took lots of screenshots, sketched the screenshots, compiled them into folders in my computer, and worked with a lot of reference photos that way to get like a sense of very, very nitty gritty time details, like which buildings were up on the street at this time in Kiev? What did the main avenue look like in 1935? Like before the war, what did it look like after? What did it look like after the Germans bombed it? What did it look like after it was restored? You know, these were all things that I thought about and tried to find a lot of historical information to discuss. And then the other kind of strange references that I would use in the book were from were actually Japanese manga and especially girls manga. So this is sort of technical and academic, but Japanese comic books, which are called manga, are separated into the comics for girls or shoujo and the comics for boys or shonen. And so and the two have very different stylistic qualities. Like the ones for boys are full of very thick lines. They're very blocky. A lot of them have to do with action and events and what is usually around sports or war, things like that. And then the girls' manga or shoujo is very emotionally driven, or sort of full of flowers. They're more kind of expansive and fluid. And although importantly, I have to note that even though one is called girls' manga, one is called boys' manga, it's not like actually gender discriminatory. Like both men and women read both. So it's just a sort of standard way of talking about it, but it doesn't mean that they're restricted in any way. Anyway, so I was really fascinated by the way that in girls' manga, things just kind of splayed out over a page. Like there were very few panels It was very, very abstract. Like one page can be entirely composed of a girl surrounded by rose petals. It was all over the place and totally fascinating. And I didn't even really read them for the story. I just found scans of them online and tried to copy how they dealt with emotion. Emotion was so keenly conveyed in those kind of looser structures. And so I just had tons of images that I had saved in my computer of the way that the pages looked, and tried to include sort of more fluid page constructions or page layouts when I was creating the book to make the book have a more emotional effect without necessarily having to say, this person was sad, this person was happy. You know, I mean, everyone knows the show and not tell thing. So I was trying to show and not tell with page layouts instead of having a character explicitly talk about their emotions.
And then how about things like the Persepolis or the mouse? These are some of the things which come up with regards to your novel. Did you see any similarities between the kind of work their authors were doing and yourself?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was very consciously trying to fit the book into a longer history of comics and graphic novels, especially autobiographical graphic novels, historical graphic novels. Obviously, Mouse, I was very, very impressed with Mouse when I read it in high school. It's been constantly in the back of my mind. And same with Persepolis. And especially after having read Alison Bechdel's Fun Home, with the way that she used text and image and how she described events and how she was able to be so raw about her own family. That was extremely influential for me. Something that I did while I was reading it was actually take a month off to teach a January term class at Harvard on the non-fictional graphic novel. So I took some time off and created a syllabus for exactly this kind of book in order to try to put it into a context and try to stay really involved and interested in it. So I included Mouse and Persepolis, as well as a book called Epileptic by David B, a French cartoonist. There are a lot of books like this that were very influential for me and continue to be very influential for me. Although I have to admit that as I was doing as I was actually creating the book, the books that I was reading were usually not graphic novels, but like the long novel, the great novel of many different historical traditions, because I thought, oh, well, I have a year off. This is the time that I have to read all of the books. And so I read like Anna Karenina and Moby Dick and all of these, like a lot of Victor Hugo. It was like the year of the long, thick novel, which actually, strangely enough, made it easier to visualize the book as a longer, as a complete long thing, because it's so easy. As I'm sure you know, like working on a dissertation, you kind of get lost in one section of it, and it's hard to kind of to get air and to figure out what the entire thing will look like. So weirdly enough, reading like the great novel made, I think, the pacing a little better. Made me understand how a certain chapter worked in the context of the whole. Although obviously autobiographical graphic novels were extremely important and an extremely important source of influence for the book.
Well, I think it's a great time to ask you to tell about the structure of your book, how it is organized, how does the narrative flow in it?
Of course. So the book is more or less chronological, although it goes back and forth in history. The book is composed of 12 chapters with interludes between each chapter. So the chapters are straight from my great-grandmother's memoir, entirely in her words, but translated into English. These are moments from her life directly in the Soviet Union. So it stretches from her birth in 1910 to her death in 2010. And her narrative stretches pretty much through the early pre-revolutionary years, through the Bolshevik Revolution, the Civil War, the Stalinist purges in 1937-38, of course, World War II, and then Stalinism and the death of Stalin and then the thaw. So all of that was seen in her own memoir, and I translated that into English and made these into separate chapters. Those are entirely her own words created, but I supply the images. And then between each chapter is an interlude in my own voice, and these interludes are pretty short. Compared with the chapters, which are from 8 to 12 pages, the interludes are anywhere from 3 to 5. They're rather short, but they're in my own voice, and they're about my relationship with my grandmother, with my great-grandmother, my relationship with my family, and the emigration experience since I emigrated in 1992. They're a little more personal, a little more raw, I think, in certain ways. They're a way to explain to show to the reader how close my great grandmother and I were, and how distanced I felt from the rest of my family and from a certain experience that they shared in the Soviet Union that I did not share. So it's a way of kind of connecting the reader who might not know that much about the Soviet Union to the story. And especially it's a way to link the two generations together. So one of the kind of smaller theses that I have running through the book is that the millennial generation has a lot that is shared with the ideals of what is called the great generation of the people that grew up around and fought in World War II and grew up around that time. So before the boomer generation, like that, I've always felt that like the people that I've met from that generation had a lot more idealism and a sort of strength that I felt conveyed with my own friends and my own experience of the millennial generation. So that was one of the theses of the book, this combination of my great-grandmother's generation and my own generation coming together in a certain way. But of course, 80% of it is my great-grandmother's story and 20% of it is my own voice.
And you said that your great-grandmother's story is based on her memoirs, right?
Yes, it is straight out of the memoirs. I don't remember a time that I changed her words. If I changed her words, it was only to use a word that is more easily understandable in English. Like if something was an acronym, like as I think you know, like Soviet speak is full of acronyms that no one understands in the American context. So then I changed those, but pretty much everything else, even her sentence structure, I kept from the memoir.
I was curious about your work with the memoirs. How did you decide what things to include and what not, what to focus on? And, you know, how did you reshape her story into your version of her story?
Yeah, that's a great question. Her memoir was very long. My great-grandmother's daughter, Tatiana, helped me type it out. So she was a lot more used to my great-grandmother's way of writing. So my great-grandmother, as you know, since you read the comic book, didn't have anything more than a fourth grade education. So her handwriting is kind of difficult to understand. It's very shaky, and especially because she was writing it when she was in her 90s and 80s. So she helped me kind of understand what she was saying and typed it out. Which was incredibly helpful. And she was very happy to do it to help me understand this script. And at the end, once we had transcribed the entire thing, it was something around 60 pages single-spaced in Cyrillic, which is an incredible and huge amount of material. I think I ended up using only 4 or 5% of it. So what I had to do was read through the entire thing several times, highlighted the parts that I thought would represented the historical period. Because she wasn't a writer and because the purpose of her writing the memoir was not to get it published, it was just for her own sake. And maybe for the sake of the rest of the family, but she wanted to do it for herself. And so a lot of the information in the memoir was sort of extraneous information about other family members, like, you know, what cousin married what other person, how they met, taking a vacation with them, you know, whose cousin knew this, who this other person, this other like person that she knew in Kiev, what they were doing, where they moved, you know. So a lot of that was, she was just trying to remember as much as possible to stay lucid, you know, to stay focused and in her old age. So a lot of it was just kind of information about the family that I didn't think was that important for other people to know. There were a lot of wonderful things that I wish I could have included, a lot of like very sweet family stories that I had to not include. And it was basically, you know, I had to kill my darlings, you know, in the parlance of creative writing workshops. But I tried to include, incorporate, obviously, the most important times in her life that she had to make a decision, you know, where she had agency. This is what I wanted to include, you know, why she decided to do this, what path she took. So it was less about the people that she knew and more about her own way of living in the world. So obviously this is stuff like her getting married, her getting involved in politics, her second marriage, her feminism in a way that was not feminist in the way that we usually think about it, but true kind of earlier feminism, if that makes sense. But so I tried to find these moments in her memoir that were the most, they were very dramatic, but also the most kind of powerful images of her as a human being that I thought would be inspirational for other people.
So do you think that the way your great-grandmother knew her and the way she comes across in your book, do you think these are different characters in the end?
I actually don't think so. She pretty much remained the same person throughout her life. Granted, this is a person that is filtered through my eyes, you know, so maybe other people that she knew might have had a different understanding of her. So this is a person that I was very close to and that I loved. And so my own lenses, right, are very different from how other people view her inherently. But I think this is like, after I wrote the book, I read it through again and thought, okay, yes, this is conveying the person that I knew, that I loved. I think when I showed the book to other people that knew her, they thought, yes, this is, they did think the resemblance was there. I think they thought that she was a little more of a, and excuse the language, but a bit of a hard ass. Like, I think they thought that she was very bossy and domineering. And my grandmother's experience of her own mother is always like, oh, she never let me do anything. She was so strict. She was always in charge, you know. And like, if I were the daughter of someone like that, I would probably have different opinions. But to me, because she was never that person to me, she was a lot kinder and a lot sweeter. So she comes across maybe not as much of a cold, hard bitch, but I kind of love that, you know, like I kind of wanted to say that there's nothing wrong with being like that, as that being a person that knows what they want and that go for it and that won't take no for an answer and that will try extraordinarily hard to get to a place that they want to be. Because that's something that I think, you know, the millennial generation also was accused of. And I don't think that's a bad thing at all, being that kind of ambitious person.
Well, there is definitely a very strong sense of dealing with, you know, a personality when you're reading your novel. But there is also a feeling that the reason why there isn't a lot of, like, you know, this intense self-analysis or self-reflection is because the very historical circumstances your great-grandmother was put into did not allow her space for doubt. She just had to act rather than sit there for, I don't know, days considering what to do.
That is a very, very good point. And I think that's something that is also reflected in people of post-Soviet background now. In my reading of other books, like I've just finished Boris Fishman's amazing novel, A Replacement Life, and he talks the exact same way about elderly post-Soviet people, that there's no space for doubt. There's no time to ruminate on these decisions. You just make the decisions and you have this trauma and you don't, you know, you're, because psychology was sort of frowned upon, you're taught not to sit and stew over these life decisions and not to analyze them. You get very used to putting them aside and just acting, you know, rather than getting obsessed over the details. And that's not something to really be, I'm not trying to praise this. And obviously I don't necessarily agree with that way of dealing with trauma, but it is something that I think is inherent to people that grew up in the Soviet Union, in my experience, where there's a kind of silence, you know, where you don't really talk about the deep, dark place, you know, that is either inside you or that you came from. You don't really talk about that. And the gap, the silences are in themselves important, and people will understand them. That is other people in this generation or from this circle. You understand what these silences mean from what your parents say. Like, they might not tell you all the details about something, but you'll know in that gap that there is something important there. And that's actually a roadblock that I ran into after the book was released, where a lot of the reviews that came out, or like just that people were talking about the book on, say, like Goodreads or Amazon, would say, I wish that the book had talked more about the kind of emotions and like she must have been so so fraught with all of these, you know, feelings and decisions, and she must have felt so she must have felt something. Why didn't you talk about that? But from my perspective, you know, why would I want to include all of these additional emotional burdens when she herself did not include them in the memoir? And the way that people talked about that time is very no nonsense, very this happened and this happened. And including all of these kind of extraneous, very American ruminations, I think would detract from the power of that experience. Because it's just not something that they do very often, I think. People from what is now Russia or Ukraine or Belarus or Uzbekistan, like there's this idea of a silence. And I think there's something powerful in kind of listening to that silence and trying to figure out what the silence means, rather than adding all of this additional emotional labor that might not actually accurately reflect their experience.
Well, following up on that, of course, the theme of the relationships within family and relationships within generation is something which is very important to your book. And I wanted to ask you how you feel the emigration and the experience of being an immigrant adds to those difficulties within the family.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that is, I think it became a big problem. I'm a part of this kind of amazing, funny Facebook group called the Anti-Trump Soviet Immigrants Group. And in reading other people's experiences, it seems that it is very common for people who emigrated as children from the former Soviet Union to have an extraordinarily different worldview from their families, and that creating an enormous rift in the family and amongst the community generally of people from that area. So people who emigrated after when they were older teenagers or adults, people who emigrated from those countries in the early 90s, when that wave came, that generation still held all of the Soviet values and were very, 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 seemed to be traumatized by that experience and decided to stick to what they knew oftentimes and to not try to assimilate too much. And, basically created these havens in the United States of Russian speaking zones where you basically didn't even feel like you were in the United States. Where I grew up in Chicago, everyone was pretty much a Soviet immigrant, at least in the first couple years. My grandparents talked to no Americans ever. we shopped at Russian grocery stores. We had Russian TV. Everything was Ukraine and Russia, specifically Russian speaking. And by contrast, they have these kids, these people of that generation who grew up pretty much American, torn between these two worlds of this very emotive, expressive, let's talk about our feelings all the time, American people and the people that they go to school with. And then they have their parents who are diametrically opposed to this personality. So I have found it to be very common in this in young people who came over around that time, where to feel that extreme rift in their families. And I think this created a lot of the scenes that you see in the book, where I feel very different from the rest of my family. And I think it continues to be a problem, not only for myself, but for other people that I know. And especially people that I've met through this Facebook group. But it becomes such an enormous cultural rift between the members of the same family that I don't know if it will ever be solved. It might just be an inevitability. It seems almost unfathomable how to cross that gap.
Well, thank you a lot for your sincerity and for all your insights you share with us today. As we are heading towards the end of the interview, I perhaps have one more question to ask you. And this is whether you envision your book being translated into Russian and whether you would like it to be translated into Russian.
Yeah, I would love for it to be translated into Russian. I've tried to get into contact with a couple of people, and although the feedback has been surprisingly good, all things considered, the difficulty is that right now it seems that Russia and Ukraine are still in the very beginning of even getting people to read comics. It still does not appear to be very popular. Like Mouse was only very recently translated into Russian, and a lot of publishers don't know how to go about printing it, or might not have the funds to do something like this. And so it's been a continuing effort. I got very close to publishing it in Ukrainian. I actually have a rough Ukrainian translation of it, and eventually I would love for that to happen. But it's just a matter of money because of economic difficulties, as you know, and the political difficulties between Russia and Ukraine, that it didn't end up working out. But it's something that I would definitely be interested in, especially since I already have the Russian. Since it was translated from Russian, I think it would be an obvious project to do. But it's definitely something I want to look into more in the future, to getting a translator for it.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with this.
Great. Thank you so much. That means a lot. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for being with us today, and have a great day.
Of course. Thank you so much. This was wonderful.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Julia Alexeeva, author of Soviet Daughter, A Graphic Revolution, as much as I did. Please stay tuned for more episodes of New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. And the next time, I'm going to be interviewing Rebecca Gold, author of Fratres and Rebels, The Literature of Insurgency in the Caucasus. So this is something to be looking forward to. And until then, this was your host, Olga Breininger. Take care and goodbye.